We are talking once again with Joff Parrish and Maria Tomchik, local writers and activists, here to give us a wrap-up of this past week's news. Good afternoon.
Good afternoon.
Good afternoon.
Getting pretty toasty already.
Yeah. At the risk of being cliche, because nobody's really talking about anything else right now, the heat wave in the Pacific Northwest is unprecedented. And if you think the 108-degree forecast for Monday is insane, most of Oregon will be 110-plus on Sunday, and not much better on Monday, and actually well over 100 today as well. This is climate change. Welcome to our new roasty planet. The all-time record for Seattle is 103. And we are almost certainly going to shatter that on Monday. We may break it on Sunday as well. And it's not just the Pacific Northwest. Europe had a really bad heat wave last week. Of course, the Southwest did a couple weeks ago. And Siberia, it was 86 degrees north of the Arctic Circle last week, which is kind of alarming, actually. Because that's permafrost territory, and the actual land temperature got to 114. That's the temperature of the soil.
Yeah, and that's a major risk of releasing a lot of methane that's trapped in the soil there into the environment, which would speed global warming even more in a kind of terrible feedback loop.
Yes, and obviously the politicians of the planet have not even begun to come to grips with that. At least we have an administration that recognizes that climate change exists. That's a important first step. But it's a first step that should have been taken 25 years ago. When you're broiling the next few days, just remember that this is a good reason to try and hold politicians accountable and get them to move on what really is an existential crisis for the entire biosphere if the human race doesn't do something about it in the next, 10 minutes. So, this should be a call to action once you've recovered.
Yeah, and in the meantime, do your best to stay cool.
Yeah, and there's
if you need
resources.
To go to a cooling center, then you should do that.
Yeah, King County has a list of cooling centers. It's under kcemergency.com. It'll come right up, and it's a King County website. And the city has put out a list of resources for dealing with the heat as well. Portland, which is a little bit warmer than Seattle the next few days, has canceled a lot of things that Seattle has not as of yet. So for example, farmers markets, any outdoor activities, actually. This is incredibly hazardous weather for a lot of people. Homeless people do not have an obvious way to get out of the heat, and that is extremely dangerous. And a lot of older housing in Seattle is not air-conditioned. So, people, and it's really hard to buy air conditioning right now because it's kind of late. Everybody's sold out. Take water bottles and put them in your freezer. Keep cold water in your bathtub.
Drink cold liquids. Make sure you're drinking enough liquids.
Hydrate. We care about our audience. So, please don't die of heat stroke this week.
Yeah, and check on others that you know might not get, might not be in communication as often.
Yeah, that's a good tip as well.
Yeah, particularly folks who are housebound, not just for COVID reasons, but maybe they're elderly. Make sure that your pets are safe.
Yes,
because they can also suffer heat stress.
Yeah, all that fur is not a good way to stay cool when it's 108 out, which is the forecast for Monday. I have a friend who is cannot leave her apartment because she's severely disabled, and we'll be checking on her on this weekend. So yeah, anybody you know like that, you know, please keep people safe. Well, with that uplifting start to our show.
Yes. All right, let's move on to this week's election coverage.
Yeah, I wanted to talk a little bit about, I know last week I promised people that we would start talking about the policies and positions of the mayoral candidates on various issues. And I wanted to talk this week about the five or six top candidates and their positions on transportation. This week was the virtual Mass Transportation Coalition's mayoral candidate forum on transportation, is sponsored by groups like 350 Seattle, Cascade Bicycle Club, the Transportation Choices Coalition, Transit Riders Union, and several other groups who are interested in and or advocate for transportation issues. The moderator was Erica Barnett of Publicola. There were only five candidates at the virtual forum: Jessen Farrell, Lorena Gonzalez, Bruce Harrell, Andrew Grant Houston, and Lance Randall. Colleen Echohawk and Casey Sixkiller were both absent. In their opening statements, some of the candidates, including Farrell, Harrell, and a volunteer who read a pre-written statement for Colleen Echohawk, seemed to forget that it was a transportation forum. Gonzalez and Houston, in their opening statements, kept to the topic, and they're the ones who seemed most informed of all the candidates. I'll just say that right up front. So here's a rundown of where those four top candidates stand on transportation, and I'll talk a little bit about Colleen Echohawk's and Casey Sixkiller's positions at the end. Jessen Farrell, and I'll take them alphabetically. Jessen Farrell is the former executive director of the Transportation Choices Coalition, and you would expect that if anyone knows a lot about this topic, it would be her. Her position that she stated in the forum, she would like to extend free transit to all of Seattle, and she mentioned the U-Pass program at the UW as an example. She supports more infrastructure for biking and walking and wants to build 100 miles of stay healthy streets. But then there's the question of how would she pay for all of that. She claims there are tens of billions of dollars available at the state level. She's a former state legislator, so she may know something we don't know. But I'm not sure that that's actually true. She claims that the legislature just has to get their priorities right. And I think maybe she's thinking that those mainstream Democrats who are more conservative than she is, it might be easier to persuade them to shift money from roads and bridge maintenance and road building projects into other transportation priorities. I'm not sure that that's as easy as she presents. She would also use car tabs and vehicle license fees to pay for pedestrian improvements, not for bridge maintenance. She thinks the city can get money for that from the state and or federal government. And I'm not sure that's as easy as she presents. She also thinks that a combination of making the next Move Seattle levy bigger and funding efficiencies in the current budget could pay for free transit for all. Again, I think that's maybe a little utopian. She thinks the city can get to net zero carbon emissions, but didn't talk about any additional specifics about how the city would get there, you know, on top of encouraging biking, walking, and transit. In general, Farrell was good on theory, but not on the specifics. My kind of overall impression of her is that her relentless positivity makes her seem like she's really trying too hard. Now Lorena Gonzalez. Gonzalez said she would work to build the 15-minute city with strong connections between neighborhoods. Gonzalez was also the first candidate to really talk about viewing transportation development through a racial equity lens. She was also the first one to jump in and say that she would support rezoning of the entire city to allow apartments in more neighborhoods. and to reduce the single family zoning that we have in about 70% of the city. She's critical of the stay healthy streets because they still allow automobile traffic, which can be dangerous for folks who are biking, rolling, and walking. She would close more streets to cars, build more sidewalks, bike lanes, and fund more rapid transit. So then the question of how would she pay for it? She would make the renewal of the Move Seattle levy bigger. That's the first thing. She supports free transit, but she doesn't know yet how to pay for it. She was very kind of pragmatic in saying that she would want to study how European cities pay for transit and look at various options before she came out and said she actually would have a plan for that. Now, Gonzalez thinks the city should commit to net zero carbon emissions by 2030 and then strive to become carbon negative after that date. And she thinks that that is doable. In addition to, and I'm not sure that that's actually doable, but she thinks that we should do it. And certainly I think this weekend's weather proves that we should. In addition to
yeah, that, I mean should is a nice yes. theoretical word.
Yeah, it's the having the plan to get there. That's the important part, and I'm not sure she quite has that yet. In yeah. addition to getting people out of the cars, she said she would work to get the city council to pass a bill to ban the construction of new natural gas pipes for new buildings. She mentioned working with Mike O'Brien on his proposed bill on this topic, which was eventually shelved. She would push, as mayor, she would push to get that done. Overall, my impression of Gonzalez is that she came across as well-informed and very competent. Even though without Casey Six Killer there, she really was the status quo candidate since she's the current president of the city council. And that means that other candidates would kind of target her for criticism. But she still came across pretty well in spite of that. Now, Bruce Harrell. Okay, Harrell's responses often sounded like word salad to me. Kind of a mishmash of terms that didn't really address the question that was asked. And he had a lot of incomplete sentences that changed the topic in midstream, which kind of makes me wonder about his focus and his ability to concentrate. But, you know, I've had those concerns about him for a long time.
I was going to say, that sounds like a summary of his city council career.
Yeah, he really had a lot of trouble sitting still and paying attention when he was on city council. He liked to go off topic. He liked to leave the room sometimes at key moments when he should have stayed there. And so I think this is not new for him. He's interested when the focus is on him and on his priorities. He's not interested when it's not. But when I could make sense of his responses during the forum, he seemed to support things like last mile shuttle systems to get more people connected to major transit hubs. And better east-west connectivity through the city, although it wasn't clear to me if he was talking about transit line connectivity or more east-west roads for cars. His responses were not very clear. He would use data mining to figure out what his transportation policy should be and where to build sidewalks and other improvements. So he's very much he's very much in favor of the kind of big data driven policies that Durkin has been trying to big data techniques that Mayor Durkin has been trying to use for things like human services, and he would use them for transportation.
It's worked so well for homelessness. Why not use it for transportation?
Right. He's a big fan of technology, and he said that multiple times, although didn't always give examples of what he means by that. As for new revenue.
I think he means like the Jetsons that will all just fly around.
Yeah, well, he drives an electric car, so I think he would continue to support single passenger automobiles as long as they're electric. And I think he actually said that at one point. He supports, as for new revenue, he would support any available revenue sources. Talk about vague, right? Any available new sources.
Didn't he oppose the head tax?
Yeah. The one, yes. The one specific source he mentioned was philanthropic, and by that he meant that the city should go begging hat in hand to large businesses to quote unquote donate money to the city for transportation projects.
And when politicians talk about philanthropy as a revenue source, what they're saying is we don't want to tax corporations, but if they want to give us money, that's okay.
Yeah, that's essentially what he was saying. He supports free transit in principle, but the city should take only incremental steps to get there. And those incremental steps include electric cars, carpooling, flex time work schedules, work from home, mumble mumble, and more east-west connectivity.
I'd like to put a memo in this weekend to climate change and say, if you can just be more incremental, we'll be fine.
Oh, yeah. And that was one of his responses. Overall, of course, he thinks the approach to transportation issues should be a problem-solving one, not a revenue-raising one, right? Don't tax corporations. But then towards the end of the forum, Harrell really seemed to lose patience and complete focus. And at one point, he was lecturing the other candidates on how young people should be taught that natural gas is a hydrocarbon because not many people know that.
So next month, we're going to have primary recommendations. And I think it's safe to say that Bruce Harrell is not going to make it.
Yeah. So you could see, you know, the other candidates roll their eyes, and I'm sure they were probably thinking like me, geez, Grandpa, get with the times, you know, you know, because his overall point was, you know, young people should be taught this stuff in school because the next generation's going to have to deal with climate change. No, Grandpa, climate change is now, and it has to be done now.
Those darn young whippersnappers.
Yeah.
Oh, my goodness.
So that was my impression of Harrell. And then Andrew Grant Houston. And to gauge the effectiveness of Houston's answers, you really only needed to look at the other candidates when he was speaking, because Jessen Farrell and Lorena Gonzalez would perk right up, you know, as if they were expecting something really cool, right? And you could kind of see them maybe taking notes by looking at the expressions on their faces. But on the other hand,
I'm going to guess Harrell went for a walk.
Yeah, that's when Bruce Harrell would get up and disappear off camera, right? which really asks, do you need a better endorsement of Houston, right? So nearly every one of Houston's responses was prefaced with either a relevant statistic or a policy prescription. So he's got this down pretty well. He would say things like, you know, 50% of carbon emissions are from single passenger automobiles, and then start talking about his policy on climate change. Or he'd say 20% of our city lacks sidewalks, you know, and you know, that's an important statistic, and it's important to show you that there's a significant number of residents who need sidewalks and they need them now. He talked about creating an exemption for net zero buildings, and because he's an architect and urban planner, he wants to redesign the city to build fully protected bike lanes and transit lanes, move cars off of arterials where commercial storefronts are, and make those arterials streets that are safe for pedestrians and bicyclists and people who do net zero. Literally, carbon-free transportation. He would lobby at the federal level for spending $1 trillion a year on infrastructure. I'm not sure how realistic that is, though. He would lobby the state government to fully fund Sound Transit 3 funding to get it built as soon as possible. And several of the other candidates said that they would do the same, including Gonzalez and Farrell. He would partner with Seattle's public utilities to use general obligation bonds to pay for fixing streets at the same time as we use that money to fix utility lines, which it seems kind of wonkish, but it is actually a really good idea. And it's something that that I think the city has been considering doing with things like using transportation dollars when you have to fix a city street to use the opportunity to put in a bike lane too. So that combining repairs and improvements is a really good idea. He had other ideas for raising revenue too. When it comes to free transit, he would put a vehicle license fee on the ballot in 2022, then work with King County to try to get to free transit in the following year or 2 years after revenue starts coming in from that. He would try to use half of the vehicle license revenue to build infrastructure to get people to bus stops as a racial and income equity priority, because so many people have been priced out of Seattle. They're no longer close to transit hubs. So that last mile connection is very important to him, as it was for other candidates like Harrell. Bruce Harrell mentioned it. So did Lorena Gonzalez. So did Justin Farrell. He also mentioned congestion pricing as a way to get people out of their cars. No other candidate really talked about congestion pricing quite like he did. And he said the revenue could be used to help pay for things like free transit, more sidewalks, or protected bike and transit lanes. He also mentioned turning Puget Sound Energy into a public utility, or PUD, again, something only he mentioned, and that he said that would make it easier for the city to decarbonize buildings in Seattle. You wouldn't be dealing with a private company that has to make a profit and so can't shift away from natural gas as easily as you can if the city owns the utility. Overall, he appeared to be a young, energized wonk in the best way, maybe a little too idealistic in some of his prescriptions, but probably too radical for a lot of the sort of mainstream Democrats in Seattle. But I really liked his responses to questions, and I think some of the other candidates did as well, because you could kind of see him taking notes and sort of bouncing off some of his ideas and incorporating some of them into their own responses. Now, I could talk about Lance Randall's positions during the forum, but he just seemed kind of bored with it all. And his mantra seemed to be, you know, sure, let's do it, but let's not spend any money, which is a very typical Republican attitude. And I think that's the end of the spectrum that he's coming from. Now, Colleen Echohawk was not at the forum, but she does have a transportation page on her website, and I checked that out. It's got a lot of very vague wording. She promises abundant transportation options and that she will advocate for progressive funding. She will make transportation available to all and use a quote-unquote mobility justice lens, end quote. And so far, so vague, right? She would build infrastructure where it's most needed. Okay. She will build more sidewalks, protected bike lanes, dedicated bus lanes, green space buffers and curb ramps, you know, same as the other candidates. She would build a regional transportation system. And here's the key phrase, and this is direct quote, without the fight for funding, end quote. And I don't know what that means, honestly. Without a fight for funding, to me, just seems like, okay, you're just hoping for this to happen. You're not really... Yeah. At the reality,
I'm gonna close my eyes and wave my arms and
She's also big on east-west connectivity, but unlike Harrell, she specifically says that she's talking about the Metro bus system. She would continue to provide free transit passes to high school students, and that's a program that's already in existence, right? She would expand the existing subsidized pass program to include more low-income residents. Okay, that's good. She would work with businesses to provide subsidized transit passes. The city already kind of does that. But she, of course, makes no mention of free transit for all Seattleites. So she apparently does not support free transit. She also makes no mention of additional funding for transportation. So that's pretty key. She has a lot of things she promises, but not a plan to pay for any of it. Other than some vague wording about leveraging federal money for a green jobs program. That's the only time she mentions additional funding. Instead, she said she would do a transportation equity assessment to prioritize which projects get built first and where. And the where is key in her program. I think she believes that South Seattle has been pretty neglected. And she would use the city's existing transportation funds, apparently. So that's Colleen Echo Hawk's program on transportation. I checked out Casey Sixkiller's website, but he has no mention of transportation at all on his website, so he does not have a policy yet. The takeaway, excuse me, from this is that of the candidates, Andrew Grant Houston and Lorena Gonzalez came across as the best, both of them very knowledgeable about the specifics of Seattle's transportation issues. Jessen Farrell was good on policy, but she was flying at 30,000 feet, you know, as someone who's been a state legislator. She still has a lot of homework to do to catch up on Seattle's specific transportation issues, I think. Bruce Harrell is out of touch and sometimes absolutely incomprehensible. Colleen Echo Hawk promises a lot without a way to pay for any of it. And Casey Sixkiller has no position yet. So that's my summary of their transportation positions. And there's a couple of key things I want to mention about the forum, too. I'm not a big fan of yes-no questions. But in the yes-no question round, there were a couple of notable questions that all of the major candidates said yes to. The first one of those is, would they support changing zoning laws to allow apartment buildings in all neighborhoods? And that is a major urbanist goal, to increase housing density. And all of the major candidates said yes, and I believe Lance Randall said no, even though he's a neighborhood developer, right? And which is very interesting. And the second question, too, is would you finish the City Connector streetcar through downtown? Of all the candidates, only Lance Randall said no, in keeping with his let's not spend any money on anything mantra. So all of the candidates view the streetcar system as real transit, and I find that kind of interesting. They all apparently think it's viable, and I don't think they're really looking at the statistics on who rides it and who doesn't. And maybe they think finishing the City Connector to connect the First Hill streetcar with the South Lake Union streetcar will turn it into a viable transit system, or else maybe like Bruce Harrell, they think that it's okay for the city to dump tons of money on something that mostly tourists are using right now.
Yeah, because who doesn't want to go to Capitol Hill, from Capitol Hill to South Lake Union via the International District?
I know. So, yeah, tourists, right? So next week is housing and homelessness. I'll take a look at that issue because that's a big one, and then we'll go from there. There are some other major issues that we'll want to look at too. But these are the two kind of big ones in my mind: the transportation problem and the housing and homelessness.
All right.
Yeah, and then by mid-July, ballots will be out, and we'll start in with our recommendations.
Yes.
Or preferences, anyway.
Mm-hmm.
All right. Okay, moving on. Our Jansley finally weighed in on the eviction moratorium this week.
Yeah, it was extended. And we'll go ahead and update COVID stuff while we're at it. But Inslee extended the state's eviction moratorium until September 30th, which is good. The city has already done that, and we saw that at the federal level, too, where the CDC extended the federal eviction moratorium, but only a month. And they said this would be the last month that they extended it for. So in states where there's not a state level or city level eviction moratorium, you're going to see a whole lot of people with back rent due starting the end of July. That's not something that anybody should be looking forward to, but that's going to be a major national problem.
Yeah. So how the eviction moratorium works, tenants who are behind on rent really need to be working with their landlords to negotiate a payment plan, or they need to work with them to try to get funding through a rental assistance program. And there are various programs available through the county, the city, and the state. Starting August 1st, renters are going to need to start paying full rent again, unless they have a payment plan in place or are in the process of getting rental assistance from the state, county, or city government. So if renters are not working right now to get something in place, you could get a nasty surprise. You won't get booted out of your apartment, but your landlord can start the eviction process on August 1st.
And I think there are a lot of people who are literally
in that boat.
$10,000 or more dollars in arrears.
Yeah, and before a landlord can start the eviction process, in at least in the city of Seattle, they have to offer tenants a payment plan first. So if you haven't already reached out by August 1st, your landlord should be reaching out to you with some kind of a payment plan. And I just want to point out that census data shows that about 220 households in the state of Washington are behind on their rent. And it is not going to be easy for them to start paying full rent plus a portion of their back rent every month. That's going to make the financial burden very high for a lot of folks. So now is the time to try to look for a way to get rental assistance or to try to work with your landlord if you can.
Yeah.
I believe California Governor Gavin Newsom, they agreed to cover unpaid rent.
Yes.
Somebody's got a phone ringing.
Yeah, sorry. I'm
okay. That. Yeah, no.
That was a spam call, too. It was really valuable.
Yeah, the state of California is using some of their federal COVID funds for back rent forgiveness, literally saying, you know, you can apply to us. We'll cover the payment of your back rent. And it also will kind of help bail out landlords who have been waiting to collect that back rent. So that's kind of an interesting development. Right. I don't know exactly how much our federal funding for Washington State is. I know that the city of Seattle has set up a fund to help with rental assistance, which is why I say there's money there at the city, county, and federal level for rental assistance programs. So that's something people should be looking at if they can't work out a payment plan with their landlord.
All right. Well, let's continue with this week's developments with the pandemic.
Well, Washington State, the Delta and Gamma variants are becoming much more pronounced. They're not dominant yet. They are in some other states, particularly states where there's a high unvaccinated rate. The Delta variant has been spreading, which is the one that originated in India, has been spreading very, very quickly. It's more transmissible even than the British variant, which is the Alpha variant. It also leads to more hospitalizations and more deaths. And bear in mind that since the population that's getting infected is younger than it was early in the pandemic, the fact that deaths are higher should be very sobering to people. This is very dangerous stuff. And both variants, so the one from Brazil, which is the Gamma, and the Delta variant from India, both are getting a strong foothold in Washington State. Gamma, not so much in the rest of the U.S., although we are seeing Delta becoming much more pronounced. Over 20% of the new infections now are the Delta variant nationally. Be very, very careful. And the stories that we're getting from other countries where Delta has become dominant are very sobering. For instance, there's a new outbreak in Israel, which had the pandemic really under control. They were the first major nation to vaccinate most of their population. Most of the people are vaccinated, And yet they're dealing with an outbreak of the Delta variant, which is often infecting people who have already been vaccinated. So it really supposedly the mask mandate for King County is going to be lifted at the end of the month. I don't think that's a good idea at this point. We still need to remain very cautious. The pandemic is not over by a long shot, and I think particularly once the weather cools off, if it ever does, you're going to see another outbreak of this virus, particularly among unvaccinated people. Nationally, 97% of new infections are among people who have not been vaccinated. So go ahead and get your vaccine if you haven't done that already.
Like we said, the gamma variant, too, affects younger folks particularly badly. So
the death rate among infants and toddlers with the gamma variant is alarmingly out of whack to other variants or other infections. Brazil's been wrestling with this for a couple months, and is now starting to show up in the United States as well.
Yeah. And even here in Washington State, where the CDC says 73% of people over 18 are vaccinated, there's a significant number of young people in their 20s, people from 18 to about 29, who have not gotten vaccinated. And if you know someone like that, you need to.
Yeah, it's 73% have gotten at least one shot. That's also the Washington Department of Health reporting that. Mm-hmm. And that means 27% of people you see have not gotten any vaccine at all. So it's not time to relax at all, particularly in indoor spaces, which are going to become more prevalent when it's really hot weather outside, right? So be careful this week, and by all means, keep your mask on.
Yeah.
All right. Anything else on COVID?
No, let's move on.
Okay. All right. Moving on, there was a devastating collapse in Florida this week. Condominium collapse.
The Champlain Towers condo building in Surfside, Florida, which is a barrier island near Miami Beach.
Yeah, it's just north of Miami Beach, and it is on a barrier island. They're obviously trying to figure out the cause of the collapse. There seem to be a number of contributing factors. One of them is the barrier island underneath the condo. The soil had been sinking for the last several years. There were also questions about the design of the building. The building had been going through its 40-year recertification at the time of the collapse. There were a number of things that are concerning.
And flooding is very common in Surfside and nearby Miami Beach area. Land erosion and flooding, due to climate change, could very well have been the cause of this disaster. Concrete buildings do not do well when they're flooded regularly. The water erodes the concrete, so that could have weakened the foundations of the building. Many, many buildings, Miami itself sits on porous limestone, so even on sunny days when there's a high tide, water percolates up through the limestone and floods large portions of the city.
And bear in mind that Miami itself, I mean, the whole metropolitan area is like a couple of inches above the Everglades,
Yeah.
It's built on a swamp.
Yeah, and Surfside is built on reclaimed wetlands. So again, not exactly stable soil. And that condo building, it's 40 years old, but it's one of the newer condo buildings in Surfside. So there's a risk for other buildings to collapse as well, something that Florida governments are going to have to deal with and we may see again in the future, unfortunately.
And I watched a lot of Miami television coverage of this. And, of course, they were interviewing structural engineers and trying to figure out – you know, what the risk was. The building literally sheared. It didn't entirely collapse, but about two-thirds of it collapsed. And they're trying, it was highly unusual. They're trying to figure that out. And
the side of the building that faced the ocean.
Yeah. It's a thing, mm-hmm. Funny thing that.
Funny and, how that happened.
And, you know, the, what's the risk to other buildings in the area? That's the question mm-hmm. also, because, obviously that's not the only building under which the soil has been sinking and shifting. And that has been subject to, flooding. This has become a chronic problem every year in Miami Beach, for example, which has much more upscale, development. And then, of course, the areas north of Surfside Beach, also have much, Bell Harbor and places like that also have much more upscale development. So you would think that with all that money at stake, you know, the governments would be more proactive, they're being prevented from some of that proactiveness by the state government of Ron DeSantis, not surprising. I found it really kind of disturbing that DeSantis and Marco Rubio and other Republican politicians that have been denying climate change for years showed up at the disaster wringing their hands and promising assistance. Because of course they have to, right? But right. It's still incredibly hypocritical because they have been the main barriers, no pun intended, to any kind of meaningful change on these topics.
Yeah. And I mean, this Republican idea that we leave everything to the private market, that, you know, insurers will let developers know what's safe and what's not safe, in the face of climate change, where we start to see rising sea levels like we've never seen before, where we start to see high tides like we've never seen before, or we see 3-digit temperatures in June like we've never seen before. That's not something that the insurance industry can let developers know about. You know what I mean?
But
it is something that governments can say, hey, this is what forecasters are predicting, and you can create regulations that determine whether or not developers can build certain buildings of a certain height in certain areas.
And, you know, when I was younger, I lived in Galveston, which is also a barrier island, and has exactly the same problem. It's got a 15-mile stretch of, you know, luxury housing on the waterfront, including beyond the seawall. And it gets wiped out by a hurricane about every 5 years, and then it all gets rebuilt. And it gets rebuilt because insurance companies are still willing to insure it. So it's, you know, the private market is not going to fix that.
Yeah,
insurance
adjusters rely on the past, on history, to determine rates and what's allowed. They don't look to the future the way a government can. So that's a very important distinction that the Republicans are just not addressing.
Yeah, they'd rather not address it, honestly, for ideological reasons. So, yeah, so that condo collapse, right now, 4 people have been confirmed dead, but there's almost 150 that are unaccounted for. Now, unaccounted for may mean they weren't home at the time of the collapse and they're okay, but it's been 48 hours now. Actually longer than that, more like 60. And so the chances of finding people alive in the rubble are decreasing with each hour. The chances that unaccounted for people were not at home are also decreasing because, you know, presumably they've gotten in touch with relatives since then, if they're okay. So the death toll from this collapse is going to go up by a lot. It's probably going to be in triple digits. It may be as many as 160 people. And that shouldn't be something that just passes with the next news cycle. And there's a lot of parts of the country that have coastal areas where development has been allowed to go unchecked, that development needs to be brought under control because of climate change. I'm thinking of places like the Outer Banks in North Carolina, mm-hmm. Galveston, most of Florida, honestly, places on Long Island. I mean, there's a lot of different places around the country that where climate change is going to literally submerge some of these luxury waterfront developments.
And you have to wonder, too, with the people who lived there, whether they were, when these studies were coming in, whether they were informed about that, you know, several years ago, that the building was suffering from problems, and that they were all sharing the risk.
Apparently they were not. The city government of Surfside Beach did not share the information, apparently.
So that's another disturbing factor to me.
Yeah, and yeah. It was a condo development, so a lot of those folks, not many of them were renters. I'm sure some of them were occupying units as like a short-term rental, like a B&B or a Airbnb rental at the time, and that's really unfortunate. But the owners of those units, because most of them were purchased and owned by people, you kind of have to do your research on a building before you purchase there, right? But those were marketed to them as luxury condos. So you pay a premium for those, and maybe you also hope that because it's a luxury condo, you're getting something of higher quality, you know, not something that could collapse on you in the middle of the night. So I don't know if lawsuits are going to be coming out of that or not, but I think it really points.
Oh, count on it.
Yeah, I think it really points to the fact that if you buy, you buyer beware, you know, you have to do your homework.
Yeah.
Yep.
Mm-hmm. All right. Well, let's move on. Infrastructure bill.
Yeah, the Senate finally agreed on an infrastructure bill. A bipartisan group met with a team from the White House and finally agreed on an infrastructure bill, although President Biden said he won't sign it until the Senate agrees on a broader spending bill proposed by the Democrats that includes many of Biden's campaign promises and things that he announced that he wanted to go into the infrastructure bill that were trimmed out of it.
And that broader bill, the Senate parliamentarian has said that they can do that through reconciliation. So they only need 50 votes to pass it.
Yeah. So, and of course, that's got the Republicans up in arms. But I wanted to talk about what's actually in the infrastructure bill that was negotiated this week. Instead of being about $4 trillion total, which is what Biden had asked for, it's about $1.2 trillion total. So it was trimmed considerably to get Republicans on board.
And that larger companion bill is about $6 trillion. And that's the part where the Democrats are intending to do it alone without any Republican support, which I think is realistic.
Yeah, and I think that $6 trillion bill is about $4 trillion of new spending. Now, in this bill, $1.2 trillion is the total of the bill. New spending accounts for about $579 billion more than is in the current budget. And here's what most of that $579 billion will cover over the next 8 years. $312 billion is for transportation. That's about one-third of the amount that was originally proposed. $109 billion will be for roads, bridges, and major transportation construction projects. $49 billion will be for transit. $66 billion for rail projects. $25 billion for airports and airport improvements, $16 billion for seaports and waterways, $7.5 billion for electric vehicle infrastructure, particularly charging stations. And the Biden administration estimates about 500,000 electronic vehicle charging stations would be funded by that $7.5 billion. And another $7.5 billion for electric buses for transit agencies around the country. Now, $65 billion will be to expand broadband access to underserved communities in the United States. $100 billion will be for climate measures. Now, I think some of that might be for mitigating potential damage from climate change, too. We were just talking about that a little bit with Florida's coastal problems. Okay, so in that $100 billion for climate measures, it doesn't include the $300 billion in tax credits for renewable energy that was in the original plan. So I just want to point that out in case people were hoping for that. It will, however, fund updates to the energy grid to connect clean power to the consumers who need to use it, and it will help fund electrification of the nation's bus fleets. $55 billion will be to provide clean drinking water to 10 million Americans. And $40 billion will go to the IRS to beef up their enforcement so that they can go after tax cheats. That's about half of what was in the original budget plan. And the idea is that through enforcement, the IRS would be able to bring in around $140 billion in unpaid tax revenue. My guess is that there's a whole lot more sitting out there that the IRS could be collecting. I don't know if $40 billion is enough for them to go after the tax cheats out there.
Note that it was the Republicans who wanted to cut that.
Oh yes, uh-huh.
Even though it would actually generate more revenue than it costs.
Oh, I know. And so this is how the $579 billion would be funded. $140 billion would come, of course, from the tax cheats. $100 billion would come from cuts to unemployment benefits as states reopen from COVID-19 lockdowns and by cutting fraud in the program at the state level. That's kind of controversial because that means some folks might get kicked off their benefits even though they're not committing fraud. They might get swept up in the zeal to kick people off who states think are fraudsters. $100 billion will come from selling public infrastructure to private companies and individuals, so privatization of some public assets, something that hasn't caused a lot of controversy. But among those of us who think that's a bad idea, that's a bad idea. It would also be funded through extending some fees that were set to expire, imposing a Superfund tax on chemicals, selling oil from the nation's strategic petroleum reserve, and auctioning off the 5G spectrum to private companies. So, again, you know, some other stuff that might not be a great idea, right? But this is what the Republicans will agree to as good revenue raisers. And of course, raising taxes on corporations and wealthy individuals are not in the plan. So that's one of the things it doesn't include. It doesn't include approximately $3 trillion in new spending on expanding healthcare access and childcare for all Americans. And making the first 2 years of college free. That's not in the plan. And spending additional money to address climate change or decarbonizing the U.S. power supply. That's not in the plan. And of course, that larger plan, as Jobs said, the Democrats will be addressing that through the budget reconciliation process, since conservative Democrats in the Senate can't agree to support getting rid of the filibuster. And of course, it doesn't include a modest increase of the corporate tax rate or efforts to raise taxes on the wealthiest Americans. So that is what's in the infrastructure bill and what's not in it.
Okay. All right. Just about 5 minutes left. Moving on.
Oh, dear Lord.
Department of Justice.
Yeah. There were several major stories yesterday, which sort of buried the Florida condo collapse and the search for survivors. One of them was that the Department of Justice has sued the state of Georgia over its new voter suppression law. And they made an important distinction in the lawsuit where they could just sue saying that the impact of the voter suppression law was discriminatory on the basis of race. But their Department of Justice is making the case, and you can read the lawsuit for yourself, that it was the lawmakers' intent in Georgia to discriminate on the basis of race. And that is a much easier hurdle to clear in court. So And of course, we saw Republican elected officials in Georgia really criticize the Department of Justice and saying this is all fake news, that it's all political, blah blah blah. It's not. You know, lawmakers are on the record as saying that their intent is to try and overturn the election results in places like Fulton County, which is where Atlanta is, which has a large African-American population, suburban DeKalb County, which also has a large African-American population, et cetera. This is how the state went for Biden last year. It's how it elected two Democratic senators in Georgia. And the Republicans who dominated the state level are trying to ensure that this cannot happen again. One of those senators, Raphael Warnock, is up for re-election in 2022, and they are specifically gunning for that seat. So the Department of Justice is challenging this, and Attorney General Merrick Garland in his press conference on this saying that they're looking at other states as well, because about a dozen Republican-led states have passed these kinds of laws, various flavors of them, trying to make it harder for people to vote, particularly people of color, students, et cetera, people who tend to vote Democratic, people who live in urban areas, et cetera. So we'll see how the Department of Justice proceeds on that. The concern is that with appeals, these lawsuits could drag on well past the 2022 election. So unless you can get a judge to agree to an injunction on some of these laws, which are already in place, they're going to be in place for the 2022 election. They're going to be in place while states redistrict. It's really a critical time coming up, and these lawsuits may be too little too late.
2 minutes to cover Donald Trump updates this week.
Yeah, well, there were several important ones. We heard the New York Times was the first to report, and then NBC confirmed that the Manhattan DA is planning to indict the Trump Organization this coming week. That's a big deal. And it's not just because the Trump Organization would be facing criminal charges, but and it depends on what the criminal charges are, of course. They could be quite serious. But bear in mind that those stories were leaked by defense attorneys, so it's likely much worse than what is being portrayed in yesterday's news stories. For instance, you could see Alan Weisselberg, the CFO of the Trump Organization, also being indicted. You could see the organization indicted on criminal charges that are much more sweeping than what has been reported, tax stuff, valuation of properties, et cetera. And then also, once a company is under indictment, no bank will lend to it. And they're likely to want to call in their loans, which, of course, we know that the Trump Organization is heavily in debt. And a lot of those loans are coming due in the next few years, and they do not have the assets to cover them. So this is something that could literally bankrupt Donald Trump once again. And the question, of course, is when he's going to face criminal liability for some of the things that he's done. And, they got Al Capone on tax evasion. I know it's a cliche, but, Donald Trump, I think, bears primary responsibility for hundreds of thousands of people dying in the pandemic. And if you got to charge him on tax evasion, so be it. I want to see that guy in jail for the rest of his life.
Yeah, and just a reminder, you do go to prison you can go to prison for tax evasion.
Yeah, and at minimum, if he's tied up in appeals for the next few years, that's going to make it more difficult for him to run for president in 2024.
Yeah.
Okay. Well, we're going to have to end it there. But we'll have you both with us again next week. So
yes, I did want to get to the Derek Chauvin verdict. That was important too, but we'll have to get to that next week.
That one got a lot of news coverage, so definitely check that out. You can just Google it and read some good articles on it.
Yeah, there's a lot of good analysis of what was and was not significant about it.
So we'll be here next week.
Yep, we will, assuming we make it through the heat wave.
All right.
Stay safe, everyone.